is Legalese, where the law is always on your side. Now introducing your host.
What is this, the Willinchick Boys?
Welcome to Legalese. This is your host, the Willinchick Boy, because Dennis Willinchick is having fun in the sun out in Europe, in the Czech Republic, I think, is where he is right now. You know, basically on the other side of the world. I think, it's nighttime over there right now. This is Jack Willinchick, and you're listening to Legalese on Independent Talk, 1100 KFNX. And we're going to start off the show today talking to somebody who just announced he's running for governor on Monday, if not mistaken, Senator Al Melvin. Al, welcome to the show.
Good to be here again.
Absolutely. And, we're talking about here the run for governor in 2014. So there's a little time, you know, before this election comes up. But, of course, given it's a state office, you've got to announce as early as you can. And you've got to start campaigning now,
mm-hmm.
right? It seems pretty early, but you've got to get started as quickly and as early as you can.
Well, there are many different forces at play here. One, many like me, are in a state of shock that Obama got elected in the first place and totally shocked that he got reelected. So under these trying conditions, it requires bold measures to protect Arizona, and that's why I'm starting. Some might call it early, but I think the time is just right.
No, that's what I'm saying. You can never start too early. One of the things before we get rolling here, I'd just like to ask you is, I know Jan Brewer herself has indicated some intent to try to run again. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, what I hear is that most, you're a lawyer, I believe.
I am.
That people who have looked at it feel that that's not a possibility for her. But she, I believe, continues to talk about it a little bit, maybe to ward off becoming a lame duck earlier than not.
Possibly.
But whether she's in or she's out, that doesn't change my position.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the issue there, of course, is that she'd be term limited, under Arizona law. Not that I've looked at this particular issue, but I know it says you've got two terms. I think maybe the legal issue she would have there is that technically she's had two terms. One of them was a partial term because she stepped in,
right?
After being Secretary of State. So I think that there is a legal issue, and I haven't looked at it. I don't know how strong an issue that is, but it could be that she's just doing it for other reasons to make it clear that she's not a lame duck. That's a possibility.
Yeah.
This is the first question I have written down here. I'm not sure why, but maybe there's a good reason. How does your wife feel about you running for governor?
Well, I've been in the political arena for 8 years now, and I'm happy to say my wife has signed off for the full time and for the future. And anybody who's thinking about getting into running for an elective office, my advice to them is check it out with the wife and make sure and the family that they're signed on. And the two Basset Hounds are on board as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know why that's my question number one in here. I think maybe your wife called the producer and said, oh, tell him not to run. He shouldn't be. If the family can't take it. No, that's a good point because, of course, right now you're in the Arizona Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And how long have you been there?
I'm starting. This is my fifth year, the start of my third term. In Arizona, in the Senate and the House, you have term limited after 4 2-year terms. So I'm starting my third term.
Right. So you'll be term limited after this term?
Well, not till it would be 2016.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But I've chosen to do this. And a friend of mine in the same district, Steve Smith, who's in the House, has already started his exploratory committee to replace me. I will keep the Senate seat till the end of 14, and we have another fellow who's going to run for his House seat. So, you know, they say nature abhors a vacuum, politics does too.
Right.
We want to make sure that all the bases are covered, and if you can nip a primary in the bud, it's good for the party.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, again, you know, one of those weird things about Arizona law, you do have to step down from your current position when you officially run for another. So I take it you're staying then in your current position, you said, until 2014.
Right.
And then you'll officially, I guess, officially run whatever the—
In January. Mm-hmm. That's the way the current law reads, that you can't go from exploratory to full-blown until the last year of your term.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned to me there's actually a bill to change that.
Yes, and there is a bill before us now where you don't have to go through those motions, so to speak. You, if the bill is signed into law, then I could go from exploratory to full campaign mode and not have to wait till January.
Right. In other words, you could run for an office while still holding another
yes.
office.
Right.
Yeah, I never really understood that law. It seems kind of strange.
Yeah.
But anyway, moving on. Right. So tell us a couple of current policies, I guess, of GM Brewer's policies that you would leave in place that you like.
Well, I think we've done some good work in working with her over the last couple of years. You know, I'd like to tell, and she gets some credit for this. I arrived at the Senate in 2009, and over the last 4 years, we went from a general fund budget of 11.6 to 8.6. $3 billion were cut out of the budget, and the world did not end. We continued to fund education at $9,000 per child during the worst of the recession. It never went below that when you include federal, state, and local funding. But by balancing the current budget that we're operating under now and the previous one, Arizona went from the bottom 10 to the top 10 of the 50 states in three categories. We're now number one for business startups. We went from 46 to 4th in job creation, and we're number 10 in overall pro-business climate compared to California at 50th.
Mm-hmm.
So good things happen, and she gets some credit for that, for working with us. I have to admit, on the other side, myself and others are going to fight Medicaid expansion to the hilt.
So that is something where you're in disagreement
yes.
with the governor. Okay. So, I mean, that leads into, I think, my next question for you, which is name some of the things that you disagree with the governor on that you would not continue.
Well, that one for sure. And I think more can be done in terms of controlling the border. We are a border state. For instance, the Arizona National Guard, I believe the governor has the power and the discretion for it to do its annual training closer to the border as opposed to Florence or as far north as Flagstaff. People like Pinal County Sheriff Paul Babu and others tell me that the bad guys, the drug runners and coyotes, they can tell the difference between military and law enforcement vehicles. If they saw a presence of the Arizona National Guard down there just doing their normal summer training, and units rotating in and out would be a good way to go. Another thing that I think we need to do, Maricopa County has got a very vigorous and well-run posse at 3,000 people. Doesn't cost the county a penny. But Sheriff Arpaio has stood up that posse. They buy their own uniforms, their own weapons, and Sheriff Paul Babu and Pinal is building up his posse. I think all 15 counties should be encouraged to have posses, and I believe that we need to do something like perhaps like a state posse, where the governor would have more flexibility, because anytime federal funds are attached, it crimps our style. We can't really fully deploy them.
All right, as you can tell by the music, we got to go out to a break here. But I'm talking to Senator Al Melvin, who just announced on Monday that he is running for the governor here in the state of Arizona. This is Jack Wilenchek on Independent Talk, 1100 KFNX.
I was gambling in Havana.
Welcome back to Legalese, your host, Jack Wilenchek on Independent Talk, 1100 KFNX. And for the next segment, I'll be talking to Senator Al Melvin. And Senator Al Melvin just announced on Monday that he's running for the governor in this state, the office of governor. So I guess we'll go back to just talking about some of the big issues that you feel are out there, some of the things that you would do if you get into office. And I know you mentioned to me that just over the break here that school vouchers is one of those things. Why don't you
Absolutely.
Talk about your position on that?
Well, in the United States, we spend more money on public education than any country in the world, around 10,000 to 11,000. In Arizona, we spend about 9,000. Yet, as a country, when we're compared to other countries around the world, we rank for over 20 years now consistently below 20 in math and science and key areas. We cannot remain a premier world power with this kind of track record. So when I am making a major part of my campaign is universal school vouchers at about 8,500 to 9,000 per child. Every child in Arizona will have a voucher for that amount of money where the parent can pick the school of their choice, whatever it may be. They may like the current district school or a charter school or parochial school, private school, but there will be maximum parental school choice. Right now, many parents are taking their children out of traditional district public schools and putting them into charter schools. And so many are doing that that the charters are being forced into a lottery system. That is a crying shame. That should not be happening in Arizona or anywhere else in the country. But by doing what I am proposing, good old American competition will kick in. Bad schools will go away. Good schools will multiply. And good things will happen.
All right. So the bottom line is, to introduce some more competitiveness
yes.
into the public school system.
And I might add that the model for that is our university system, where a GI Bill, federal money, can be spent at Notre Dame and Southern Methodist University, church-related universities, Harvard, Stanford, private universities, U of A, ASU. It's the same concept, and we've got a stellar university system.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, before I forget, I do want to talk a little bit about your background. You worked at a university for some time.
Well, I'm an Eagle Scout, which helped me get into the U.S. Merchant Marine Academy, which is one of the five federal academies, along with West Point, the Air Force Academy, Annapolis. And then I went on to make a career spanning over three decades in international trade and transportation. I went to sea for 9 years. I worked overseas ashore as an American businessman for shipping companies, and at the same time had a 30-year career in the Naval Reserve, retiring as a Navy captain in 1999. That's the equivalent of a full colonel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, impressive. I thought I saw, though, you worked at the University of Arizona.
Yes, yeah. I did. I taught for 5 years at the University of Phoenix, the University of Arizona, and Western International University, teaching economics, international business, and management courses. But when I came to the Senate 5 years ago, I thought I could do both, but I've made this a full-time job, and I had to give that up.
So needless to say, you're not a young 28-year-old guy like I am. But what are you just saying, that 60 is the new 50?
Yeah. Well, I was mentioning I'm 68, never felt better in my life. And we were talking before during the break that many people believe that today's 60 is yesterday's 50. I noted and have noted that President Reagan was 70 years old the day he walked into the White House and had 8 years of stellar service there. So I've never felt better in my life, and I'm a cancer survivor. I row every day for a half hour, the equivalent of 3 miles or 5,000 yards, burn 250 calories, and I'm firing on all cylinders during the day. And this is a big part of a major campaign like this. You got to be physically and mentally fit for it.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's turn back to the issues.
Yes.
tort reform. Tort reform is one of your big issues. So explain your position on that.
Well, I know you're a lawyer.
I am.
But there are quite a few lawyers that I've talked to who believe that this is a good thing. Where Obamacare has no mention of tort reform, no mention of what they call defensive medicine, where doctors spend over $800 billion a year in extra tests to protect themselves from a lawsuit.
Mm.
So instead of ordering two exams, they order six or eight. So Texas some years ago effected major tort reform, basically capping pain and suffering at $250,000 per incident. And as I say, and I don't want to tick you off here, three things happened. Lawyers started leaving the state, doctors right. started arriving, and business flourished, really. And if you talk to...
Not the legal business, but yeah.
But if you talk to, you know, the listeners, if you talk to your family physician, we need this. We really do.
Yeah.
For the overall medical practice here in the state. It's a good thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, as you point out, clearly that's going to be very, very, very unpopular with the plaintiff's bar, you know, the kinds of lawyers who do medical malpractice cases.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's pretty, I don't know, 250 seems kind of low.
Well, it
yeah,
could be
you know.
Some,
well, it's just for pain and suffering, though, you said.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I'll reserve judgment on, on that.
And another one that I'd like to mention, this is major. If one, there's a great website called arewenotastate.com. If you look at that website, there's a map of the United States. I didn't know this until I arrived at the Senate, but all of the Midwestern states from the Dakotas down to Texas and east, all of them are 98% private. Not so in the West. At the most, we're 18%, maybe as low as 12 or 13%.
But I missed it. Private and
property. Private property versus federally controlled land.
Oh, okay, land.
Yeah,
sure.
Land.
Real land.
Okay,
real property.
Yes. So when people look at the Dakotas and the low unemployment in North Dakota, the fracking for oil and gas, it's all private land.
Right.
Where here, we're 13 to 18%. So... we're working with other western mountainous states, Alaska, Idaho, Wyoming, Montana, Colorado, Nevada, Utah, New Mexico, to go after specifically the Forest Service and BLM land and convert it to state land.
Huh. You said it's 13% state-owned here, public?
No. In Arizona, of all the land, between 13 and 18% is private.
Private. Oh, wow.
Private.
Yeah. That's incredible. I know part of that is historical because, you know, historically when Arizona was created, it was like more land than previously in other states was made public, like twice as much land was made public. So from the very start, from 1912, Arizona's had like twice as much public land as any other state.
Well, but Nevada and Alaska are even worse.
Right.
It's only like
2%
is private.
Exactly.
But, you know, how can Western states compete with the Midwestern states and the Eastern states? So the other thing is I believe and we believe in these states that the Forest Service and BLM are mismanaging the forests because of the spotted owl and all of this. They've stopped the forestry business, the harvesting of the forest. The mining industry is almost ground to a halt as well as cattle grazing. So when we have forest fires, they're devastating as compared to properly harvesting the forest. So we believe this will be a major game changer and will help Arizona realize its true wealth and prosperity.
Yeah, you basically saying there's just a lot of unused public land sitting out there. No, that's absolutely true. And I guess people forget the reason for that is again, you know, it's owned by the state. I mean, it's historically been owned by the state. You gotta change that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you know, we just got just a little bit of time here before we have to run to our break. But before we do that, you know, in the second half of the show, we'll be talking about water rights.
Yes.
We've got a guest coming on who I guess his big thing is that he says the Colorado River is dammed, quote unquote. It's running out of water. But I know you'll be sticking around for the rest of the show here.
Absolutely.
So, we're talking with Al Melvin, and this is Jack Wilenchek, an independent talk, 1100 KFNX.
You have the right to remain silent.
That's what I want.
If you give up the right to remain silent,
freedom.
Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law.
Freedom.
You have the right to speak with an attorney.
Get me my lawyer!
Freedom.
And to have the attorney present during questioning. If you so desire and cannot afford one, an attorney will be appointed for you without charge before questioning. Now, do you understand each of these rights I've explained to you?
Get me my lawyer! I've been
All right, now that you've all been properly Mirandized, we can continue the interrogation. This is Jack Wilenchek on Legalese, Independent Talk, 1100 KFNX. And for the second half of the show here, we'll be talking about, what personally I think is, in the short time I've been alive, I'll let it slip. I'm only 28 years old. Water rights and the issue of whether we have enough water has never really been a big issue in my lifetime. I know historically, of course, being that we're a desert state, it was one of the biggest issues in the history of the state. But, in the time I've been alive, it hasn't really been on people's minds that much. So we have right now on the show, we have a guest by phone from Colorado, Gary Walkner, who's a campaign coordinator for SaveTheColorado.org, to talk about, I guess there was recently a study that says the Colorado River is one of the most, quote, endangered rivers in America. So we'll ask him to talk about what that means. I also have in studio here Tom Buschowski. Did I pronounce that correctly? It's a tough one like my name, but I'm proud I pronounced that correctly. Assistant Director of Water Planning at the Arizona Department of Water Resources. All right, so do we have Gary? Gary, are you there on the line?
I sure am. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. So let me turn to you then with that first question about the study that says the Colorado River is the most endangered river in America. What does that mean?
Yeah, well, last year the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation and Department of Interior came out with a study that basically showed that the Colorado River is currently overtapped. In other words, we're taking more water out of it than is going back into it, and that is only going to get worse in the future. So that is because of all sorts of things, new dam and reservoir projects planned around, population growth, climate change is predicted to continue reducing the flow in the Colorado River. So there are a number of threats to the river, and of course, as you know, it feeds and provides thirst water for about 35 million people throughout the southwest U.S. and in northern Mexico. And so it's under severe stress, and so the national organization made that announcement.
All right. So, what's your position on this? Do you think this is a result of bad water management, or is this natural things that are going on here?
It's really two things. There's tremendous stress on the river. We have tapped it. Of course, you may or may not know this, but the river's bone dry when it reaches the Gulf of California. It no longer reaches the sea. About 5 trillion gallons of water are drained out of the river every year. To go to cities, of course, in Denver and northern Colorado, all the way to southern California, and, of course, there in Phoenix and Tucson also. And, of course, the vast majority of water goes for agriculture throughout the southwest U.S. And so there's a number of threats to the river and ongoing threats. There's also a lot of opportunities, too. One of the biggest opportunities is to invest more in water conservation throughout the southwest U.S., especially in cities and also in agriculture. So there's some hope and opportunity in this story, too.
Hmm. All right. As I said before, I also have Thomas Buschowski sitting in the studio here, Assistant Director of Water Planning at the Arizona Department of Water Resources. Tom, let me ask you for your comment on this.
In relation to that American Rivers pronouncement about Colorado River being one of the most endangered, and the issue of the uses exceeding the supply of the river, it's something that we have known for quite a while. We've known since the 1960s. There's been several studies prior to this basin study looking at supply and demand imbalances. We knew this was an issue. The 7 basin states, along with the federal government and recently the Republic of Mexico, have taken a lot of management actions to start to address this issue. We've allowed for off-stream water banking, so water that's not being used directly can be stored under the ground for the future. In Arizona, we've put either through the state or individual water providers have put over 9 million acre feet of water into the ground or ready for future use. We've looked at new ways to manage Lake Powell and Lake Mead conjunctively, which helps the efficiency of those reservoirs in relation to the overall water use. Last November, the federal government entered into a Minute 319 of the Mexico Treaty with Mexico, which allowed for Mexico to use Lake Mead to store some of its excess water, as well as to do some environmental restoration in the delta. We heard earlier that the river doesn't flow to the Gulf of California anymore. That's true, but...
Yeah, when did that stop being the case? When did it, I guess, dry up and not meet the Gulf?
I'm not sure when it actually stopped, and in years where there are high flows, like 1983, it flowed, 1995, recently 2005, there's at least been flows into the delta. I'm not sure if they've made it all the way to the Gulf. So there is some water dedicated through some conservation efforts in Mexico to doing some pulse flows and base flows that can do some environmental restoration in the delta, so to speak. So we are being very proactive in addressing these issues, and there's definitely issues out there. We know about them, and we're working diligently to take care of them.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned, I know you mentioned the Republic of Mexico. You know, I take it this is a regional issue. It's not just, you know, Arizona would be affected by this. Well, I guess maybe, why don't we back up a little bit and talk about that. What are the other states that depend on the Colorado River for water? And I guess it didn't occur to me that Mexico depends on it to some extent, too.
Right, so there are basically seven states. It's Wyoming, Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, and California that share in allocations of the river. And the first four states, New Mexico, Colorado, Utah, and Wyoming, have rights to 7.5 million acre feet of water. The three lower basin states, Arizona, California, and Nevada, have rights to 7.5 million acre feet as well. In a treaty with Mexico in 1942, Mexico has a right to 1.5 million acre feet.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you add all that up, that's 16.5 million acre feet. There are some losses along the way, transmission losses, phreatophyte use, trees on the river, et cetera. So environmental uses kind of that don't have an allocation but nevertheless use water. The long-term average annual flow of the river is closer to 15 million acre feet. Those four states in the upper basin, Colorado, New Mexico, Utah, Wyoming, are not using their entire 7.5 million acre feet. So we just recently reached the point at which the uses exceeded the long-term average annual flow, again, which is about 15 million acre feet. In the basin study that was referred to earlier, they looked at a whole bunch of different potential flow scenarios moving forward. For example, the climate change flow scenario had a very wide range of potential flow from as low as 11 million acre feet to as high as 18 million acre feet. Certainly, we're not planning on the 18 million. We're planning more at the lower end because it's the prudent thing to do. So trying to predict the future flows in the river is a difficult task and has a lot of uncertainty. Those of us who do water planning and water management deal with uncertainty all the time. And we know that we have to deal with uncertain data. We
sure
kind of look at it from a risk management standpoint and kind of take care of business that way.
Yeah, I think the bottom line to what you're saying is that this is an issue that is not brand new. I mean, I guess it's hard to imagine how it would be. You know, it's a river, and it's been there for a while. So we've known about this issue for a while. I guess my question, I'll throw it out to both you guys, is there urgency to this? Is this something that we need to start doing something about right now? Gary Walkner, who I have on the phone here, is this an urgent issue?
Well, from our point of view, it is an urgent issue because the river is in bad shape. You know, the bottom line is that, you know, you introduced this section talking about water rights, and for the most part, not everywhere and in every single place, but for the most part, all water rights get taken care of. You know, the cities get their water, the states get their water, the farmers get their water. But the river is always the one to suffer, and it's kind of the last in the line. And so, for example, in Colorado, we just had a huge snowstorm here the last few weeks, but we've been in the drought for a long time. And so when there is a drought, the river is always last in line, and the river kind of only gets water when everybody else gets what they need. So we think there is a sense of urgency and an endangerment for the river itself. And so not only is this endangerment announcement important, but also it's important, you know, as was previously mentioned, to start talking about, well, what are the opportunities moving forward? And there's a lot of opportunities. Also, as previously mentioned, the idea of water banking, what happened in the agreement with Mexico was a great step forward. And there's huge opportunities with conservation efficiency because they're cheap and they're fast and they're easy. And a lot of things that are the smart things to do end up also being some of the cheapest things to do.
You know, well, there's the music. We got to run into a break here, but we come back. I'm talking to Gary Walkner from SaveTheColorado.org, also Tom Buschowski, who's Assistant Director of Water Planning, the Arizona Department of Resources. And I've also still got in the studio here Senator Al Melvin. I know, Senator, you had a comment to make about this, about the desalinization plant, so we'll get to that.
Okay.
This is Jack Wilincheck and Independent Talk, 1100 KFNX.
I'm hiding in Honduras.
Welcome back to the show. This is Jack Wilincheck on Legalese, 1100 KFNX. And, you know, for the last segment of the show here, we're talking about, you know, what may or may not be an impending problem here with our water supply. I guess that's what I'm trying to get to the bottom of. I'm talking to Gary Walkner from SaveTheColorado.org, referring to the Colorado River. There was recently a report that the Colorado River is, quote-unquote, endangered, the most endangered river in America. Also, Tom Buschowski, Assistant Director of Water Planning at the Arizona Department of Water Resources. And I have in studio here Senator Al Melvin from Tucson, who recently announced he's running for governor. And you know, I know, Senator, you said you had a position on desalinization and potentially a long-term solution to the water supply issues. So
yes.
Go ahead and tell the audience.
Just really quick, and I didn't dream this up on my own. I heard it from Herb Guther, who was a former director of the Arizona Department of Water Resources. But, you know, we need to have a vision for the future. And what is the vision for the state? Mine is to make it the most prosperous state in the nation. Where is our current and future water going to come from? And for the future, not that far away, I think it's desalination. Working out an agreement with California and Mexico to build desalination plants on the Pacific coast where we would barter electricity to them to run those plants, and in return they would give us some of their Colorado River water rights, which would flow into our canals where we're not pumping desalinated water back 500 miles to us here in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And I truly do believe, as I told you, that for us to prosper, we need water, electricity, and transportation that are affordable, plentiful, and reliable. Yes, we need to conserve as much as we can, and we should continue that. But I really believe that this is the answer, and we need to pursue it. I believe that that electricity is going to come from nuclear, as opposed to wind and solar, which I don't think are going to cut it. But we could debate that at another time.
Basic idea there is the trade-off, you know, or one natural resource for another, I guess, or, you know, electricity for water.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, going back to the topic here about the Colorado River being endangered, I was just saying over the break, you know, maybe this is a stupid question, but how does a river ever really get, quote-unquote, endangered? I mean, it's we might deplete it, but it's never going away. And, you know, Tom, you had a good response to that. You said that in certain ways there would be permanent damage, you know, if nothing else to natural habitats, to natural wildlife. Go ahead and explain that.
Well, I think one of the potential impacts, and impacts I think we've seen, is that we've changed the way the river flows in terms of the peak flows from the snow melt in the spring. And a lot of species, plants and animals, are adapted to that peak flow in order to reproduce. And what happens is other species that are more adapted to a different flow regime have moved in certain circumstances. Some of the flows that support some of the recreational opportunities, some of those folks see that as a detriment, having had those flows decreased. Some of the reservoirs have taken sediment out of the river, so beaches that were formerly formed along the river that are used for camping sometimes aren't there, or they're smaller and things like that. So there are some potential impacts there, but there are also programs that are in place dealing with that in the Upper Colorado River Basin. They have an endangered fish recovery program in the lower basin along California and Arizona. We have a $650 million multi-species conservation plan, which is doing environmental restoration. that's being paid by Arizona, California, Nevada, and the federal government. So while there are some environmental impacts, there are programs in place to address those as well and try to restore some of those environmental benefits.
Okay.
Go. I have a question sure, for Tom. I'm told that because we are not harvesting our forests, where the Forest Service and the BLM have basically stopped that industry, that instead of the ideal of having, say, 60 mature trees per acre, we have like 600. And the result is they're sucking the water out of the water table. For the sake of discussion, I would just like to pose to you and Gary, what would be happening in the West if we had a vibrant forest industry where we were harvesting the forest properly? Wouldn't that be contributing more water to us, conceivably to the Colorado River and local consumption, than we have now?
I'm going to take a shot at that.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
So, yeah, Gary Walkner here with Save the Colorado River Campaign. You know, the senators proposed three pretty radical and controversial ideas now. One is desalination. Desalination is very expensive. Desal plants can cost almost $1 billion, and taxpayers end up paying for that. They use vast amounts of energy, and the senator proposed using nuclear power for that, which is also extremely controversial. And now the idea of cutting down trees to increase water runoff, that's also extremely controversial. I would suggest that there's a lot of non-controversial, or certainly less controversial and cheaper ways to move forward on the Colorado River, primarily focusing on some of the things that Tom mentioned earlier, which is water banking, getting cooperative relationships with farmers, especially, and also focusing on water conservation, farms, and cities. So it is somewhat of a crisis that is coming towards us, but smart and efficient and less expensive ways to do it, and that are much more likely to succeed than proposing extremely expensive and extremely controversial ideas like desal, nuclear power, and cutting down trees to increase runoff.
Let me get the opinion here of Tom Buschowski from the Assistant Director of Water Planning at the Arizona Department of Water Resources.
Well, and I think part of the answer to that question is you have to look at this in the short term and in the long term. In the short term, some of the low-hanging fruit that you described, conservation, fallowing, transfers from ag, there are potential things we can do. But in the long term, we might need to do some of the things the senator referred to. And I understand they're controversial, but there is no silver bullet. There is no next bucket we can go to. There need to be a lot of programs cobbled together to make the resiliency that we need to meet our future demand, to protect the flow of the river, to protect those environmental values, to protect our economy. You talked about water conservation, and that's a very important thing. There's different conservation potential, perhaps, in different areas of the Colorado River Basin. The best way to describe what Arizona's done in the conservation and efficiency arena is to listen to these numbers. In 1957, the state used 7 million acre-feet of water. In 2010, the state used 7.6 million acre-feet of water. So that's a 7% increase in water, while our population went up 470%. And our gross domestic income went up 1,528%. There's lots of ways to measure conservation efficiency. That's a really good way to show how you link population and the economy and the value of water to those folks and to our economy.
So what are some of the things that we do as a state to conserve water, either on a large, you know, project kind of level or even just, you know, on an individual person kind of level?
In the populous areas of the state called active management areas, we have mandatory, legally enforceable, enforced by our department, conservation requirements. They have to meet certain guidelines and do certain best management practices. Many of those best management practices are listed in the basin study as things people should be doing. We're already doing them. So we have low-flow plumbing codes that require you to put in low-flow showerheads, low-flow toilets. We have a strong educational program to get people to save water. We have a whole variety of things. Some of the individual water providers do rebates for landscaping to low-water use plants. Some of them have toilet rebates for low-flow toilets. They have lots of different programs that, again, when you add up the value of all these programs together, I think they're reflected in the numbers I talked about earlier in terms of how efficiently, at least in Arizona, we're using our water supplies.
Mm-hmm. So, in other words, we are doing a lot of these things that I think, Gary, you were saying we should be doing. You know, mostly the low-hanging fruit type of ways of conserving water. Gary, are there other things that you think that the state here should be doing, or that that should be done to preserve our water supply? And I guess you know, take the Colorado out of the list of endangered rivers in the United States.
Yeah, and Arizona, you know, is doing a fair job right now. There's a lot of opportunity, I think, again, for low-hanging fruit and the things that are cheapest. It's important to focus on what is cheapest and fastest, easiest first. I think, and Arizona's making some reasonable strides at that. There's just a lot more opportunity before we start talking about extremely expensive, extremely controversial, and extremely difficult projects that would, you know, likely end up hanging in court forever and, you know, would cost billions and billions of dollars. So,
all right. Well, you know, I'm a lawyer. If something hangs up in court forever, it's a good thing for me. All right. I want to thank my guests. By phone from Colorado, Gary Walkner from SaveTheColorado.org. In studio here, Tom Buschowski, Assistant Director of Water Planning at the Arizona Department of Water Resources. Also in studio, Senator Al Melvin of Tucson just announced he's running for governor. Thank you guys so much for coming on the show. This is Jack Wilencheck on Independent Talk, 1100 KFNX.